we'd picked up 30 miles back. He was handling his problem moderately well, too, for a guy who could use only one hand. Croker told me, don't let motivation get in the way of good sense. When all the rest is said and done, we're still the Black Company. We get the other guys to do the dying. I'm in control. I was a Black Company brother a lot longer than I was Sari's husband. I learned how to manage my emotions. He didn't seem convinced, and I understood. He was concerned not about me as I existed right now, but as I would in a crunch. The survival of the whole company might hinge on which way one man jumped when the shitstorm hit. The captain glanced back. Despite their best efforts, our escort had begun to string out. He paid no attention to them. He asked, "Learned anything about your in-laws?" Again? He never let up. And I didn't have an answer for him. How about love is blind? Mergen, you're a damned fool if you really believe that. Maybe you ought to go back and reread the books of Croker. He lost me there. What's that supposed to mean? I've got me a lady, too. Still alive, granted. We've got plenty tied up in each other. We made us a baby together. Any two fools can do that by accident, of course, but it's usually a benchmark in a relationship. But what we have as man and woman, father and mother, doesn't mean I trust Lady even a little in any but that one way. And she can't trust me. It's the way she's made. It's the life she lived. Sari never had any ambitions, boss. Except maybe to get me to actually go into the farming I'm always talking about, so I wouldn't get scragged gloriously in some typically heroic military manner, like falling off a horse and drowning while I was crossing a creek during the rainy season. Sara never worried me, Mergen. What bothers me is this uncle, who doesn't act like any other Nguyen Bao I've ever seen. Hey, he's one old guy who has a thing about swords. He's a priest and his scripture is sharp steel, and he's got a grudge. Just keep him pointed toward the Shadow Master. Croker nodded grimly. Time will tell. He did grim very well. We crossed the great stone bridge Lady had ordered built at Goja. Crows filled the trees on the southern bank. They squabbled and carried on and seemed to find us highly amusing. I said, I worry more about those things. Croker didn't respond. He did order a halt to rest the animals. So many had gone south ahead of us that there were no well-rested remounts available. Amidst all the saluting and hasty turning out of an honor guard and whatnot, I stared southward and said, that little clown is making damned good time. I had asked already and had learned that One Eye was still a day ahead. We'll catch him before we get to Dejigore. Croker eyed me as though he feared the city name would strike me with the impact of some terrible spell. I disappointed him. Tidae, who could follow the conversation because we were speaking Taglian, showed no reaction either, though the siege had been as terrible for his people as for the company. Nguyen Bao seldom betray any emotion in the presence of outsiders. I told Tidae, give your horse to the groom, and let's see if we can't find something decent to eat. Living on horseback is not a gourmet's delight. For the same reason there were no fresh remounts, there were very few delicacies at the Goja Fortress. But because we belonged to the Liberators' Party, we were given a newly taken gamecock that was so full of juice and substance my stomach nearly rebelled at taking it in. After eating, we got to stay inside, out of the cold, and get some sleep. I should have stuck to Croker, in case his talks with local commanders turned up anything that belonged in the annals. But after a short interior debate, I chose sleep instead. If he heard anything worthwhile, the old man would tell me. If necessary, I could come back with smoke later. I dreamed, but did not remember the dreams long enough to note them down. They were unpleasant, but not overpowering or so terrible Tidae had to awaken me. We were back on the road before sunrise. We overtook One Eye, passing through the hills that surround Dejigore. When I first glimpsed his wagon and realized it had to be him, I started to shudder and had to fight an urge to kick my mount into a faster pace. I wanted to get to smoke. Maybe I had more of a problem than I wanted to admit. I didn't show it enough to be noticed, though. One eye never slowed down a bit. There'd been some changes since my days of Helen de Gigore, or Jaikur, as its natives called it, or Stormguard, as it was named while it was the seat of the deceased Shadow Master Stormshadow. Poor witch. She'd been totally unable to guard the Shadowlands against the storm of the Black Company. The plain outside the city had been drained of all water and cleared of wreckage and corpses, though I thought I could still smell death in the air. Prisoners of war from the Shadowlands still labored on the city walls and inside the city itself. Why seemed problematic? There were almost no Jaikuri left alive. Interesting notion, planting the plain in grain, I said, seeing what looked like winter wheat peeping through last year's stubble.
One of Lady's ideas, Croker replied.
He still watched me as though he expected me to start foaming at the mouth any minute. Anywhere there is a permanent garrison, one of the responsibilities of the soldiers is to raise their own food. When it came to the logistics of war, Lady was more the expert than Croker. Till we came to Taglios, he was never part of anything bigger than the company. Lady had managed the war-making instruments of a vast empire for decades. The old man simply left most of that stuff to Lady. He would rather lie back, scheming his schemes and piling up the tools Lady could use. The crop notion wasn't new. Lady had done the same around most of her permanent installations in the north. You gotta go with what works. Helps keep the neighbors more tractable, too, if you aren't stealing their daughters and seed grain. You sure you're all right? Croker demanded. We were nearly at the foot of the ramp to the North Barbican. One eye was no more than 100 feet ahead now, perfectly aware of our presence, but not slowing down a bit. I guess I was starting to push ahead.
I've got it under control, Captain. I don't fall off into the past anymore, and I hardly ever wake up screaming. I hold it down to a little shaking and sweating.
Anything starts getting to you, I want to know. I expect to be here a while.
You're going to need to be able to take it.
I won't screw up, I promised. Chapter 9. I did not wait long after Tyday and I took up quarters in one of the same buildings we had occupied during the siege. Reconstruction hadn't reached that part of town yet. Some of the old litter still lay around. At least they got rid of all the bones, I told Tyday. He grunted, looked around like he expected to see ghosts. You be all right here? I asked. Yuang Bao do believe in ghosts and spirits and ancestors who follow you around, nagging if you haven't gotten them buried properly. A lot of Yuang Bao pilgrims passed over here without benefit of the appropriate ceremonies. I must have everything ready when Doge comes. That was a major speech for Tai Day. Uncle Doge was a priest of some sort. Presumably, he would take this opportunity to complete what he hadn't had time to do 4 years ago. You go ahead. I have things to do. Far places to see. Pain to be given the slip, though I did not admit that directly even to myself. Tai Day started to put his few possessions aside. No, it's more of that secret company stuff that I'm expected to do alone. Tai Day grunted, almost pleased to have his time be his own. It always was his, but he wouldn't listen when I insisted he didn't owe me. If it weren't for me, he wouldn't have lost his sister and son. Arguing with a Nguyen Bao is like arguing with water buffalo. You can't get through, and after a while, the Nguyen Bao loses interest in listening. Might as well save your energy.
Wondered how long it would be, One Eye said when I tracked him down.
He'd brought the wagon into our old part of town, but had not taken smoke out. He had it backed into a tight alleyway where, I presumed, the wagon would vanish inside camouflaging spells as soon as he dealt with his team.
Unhitch them animals, kid, and get them over to the transient stable while I straighten up here.
Arguing with One Eye gets to be a little like arguing with Nguyen Bao. He goes completely deaf. He did so in this instance. He went about his business exactly as though I wasn't there. In the interest of efficiency, I took care of the animals. I believe I did a little grumbling about wishing Goblin was back. That little toad of a wizard goblin is One-Eye's best friend and worst enemy. He was so hard to find, I thought, at first, that I was having trouble getting Smoke to understand what I wanted to do. Then I tried going back to where I had seen him last, in the river delta on the edge of Nguyen Bao country. My plan was to follow him forward in time to where he was now. And that worked just fine till Goblin's ship entered a fog bank and never came out again. Smoke couldn't find him. It took me a while to comprehend that Smoke might have been primed to shy away from what Goblin was doing. Maybe to keep One Eye from finding out and interfering. It would be just like the little shit to blow a whole operation because he didn't think before pulling some nasty practical joke on his friend. I did some experimenting. Sure enough, Smoke had been given some special instructions. The old man hadn't given up visiting him completely. Once I knew that, I had little difficulty getting past Croker's safeguards. I fear One Eye would have had little more trouble. I found Goblin standing on a sandy beach far down the uncharted coast of the Shindai Kus, a terrible desert that fills a vast chunk of land between the northern and southern regions of the Shadowlands. The impassable mountains called the Danda Presh only get shorter out there before they finally wade into the ocean. Goblin was looking out to sea. A ship rode her anchor inshore. Boats were plunging in the surf. Goblin was yammering a litany of complaints. From the faces of his companions, it was safe to guess that they'd heard it all before. What the hell was Goblin doing out there on that bleak coast? I dropped back in time to listen in from the beginning. Goblin was tormented by hatreds. So what does the captain do? He sends nobody else but Goblin himself off to chart the unknown coast. Goblin hated swamps, so naturally the first leg of the journey took him downriver through the delta, which was one huge swamp, 200 miles across, without one decent channel, obviously totally unfit for human habitation because only Nguyen Bao lived there. Goblin hated sea travel almost as much as One Eye did. So what did he get after cutting through the swamp, damned near building a canal to manage that? A goddamn ocean with waves taller than any self-respecting tree. He hated deserts. So, what did he find after he finally got his little fleet past the end of the swampy coast? Country so barren, scorpions and sand fleas couldn't make a living there. You baked during the day and froze at night, and you never got away from the sand. The wind blew it into everything. He had sand in his boots right now.
"I wasn't born for this," Goblin complained. "Nobody deserves this. Me less than most. What did I ever do to the old man? All right, so maybe me and One Eye drink a little and get rowdy sometimes, but so what? It's just youthful high spirits if Sleepy does it."
Naturally, he overlooked the fact that when he and One Eye get drunk, they always start squabbling and tend to begin throwing sloppily woven spells around, busting things up far worse than Sleepy ever could.
"A man has to cut loose sometimes, you know what I mean? Nobody ever gets hurt, do they?"
That was not an exaggeration. That was an outright fabrication.
"Hell, in a world where there was any shred of justice, I'd be retired somewhere where the wine is sweet and the girls appreciate a man with experience. I gave the company the best centuries of my life."
Goblin hated being in charge. That meant having to think and make decisions. And it meant taking responsibility. Goblin hated all those things, too. He just wanted to cruise through life, doing only what was necessary to get by, while somebody else did the thinking and made the decisions. Goblin hated hard work, too, and in this desert, everybody was going to have to bust ass to stay alive. I had Smoke take me up high, with the eagles, had any been able to survive out there, to see what had Goblin so excited. He had not exaggerated about the desert. Near the coast, the Shindai Koos was all golden sand. The surf brought that in from the deep. Continuous gales carried that sand inland, using it to scour the skin off hills that, as they grew up and marched to the east, became the Danda Presh. On the coast, few of the hills stood more than 100 feet above the sand. None of those showed the least sign of water erosion. It hadn't rained there for 1,000 years. I started to descend. Goblin and two others were walking inland, slowly, testing the surface. Something exploded out of the sand ahead. An impossible something. A monster that couldn't exist in this world. A devil thing the size of an elephant, but with more legs and hair than a tarantula, plus some squid-like tentacles and a scorpion's tail thrown in for good measure. It staggered around groggily. Obviously it had lain there a long time, awaiting the footsteps that called it forth. Goblin's companions fled. The little wizard cursed and said, "Another thing I hate is things that jump up out of the sand." While the monster was still woozy, he hit it with some of his best stuff. Something like a yard wide, a three-legged stained glass throwing star appeared in his hand. He used it like a throwing star. The monster bellowed in outrage as the star clipped a couple tentacles and several legs off its right side. It tried to charge Goblin, who elected for the better part of valor and hauled ass. The monster sort of dragged itself around in a big circle, leaving ruts in the golden sand. It lost interest in the man on the beach. For a while it tried to put its severed limbs back on, but the graft wouldn't take. Finally it just sort of shuddered fatalistically and began to dig itself back down into the sand with the limbs it still had.
"And another thing," Goblin complained, "I hate the whole concept of the Shaded Road."
Shaded Road was some secret project kept from me because I'd had no need to know. I had overheard the name mentioned once or twice.
I'm even beginning to wonder how much I like Croker. This shit is pure insanity. I hope the son of a bitch gets to spend his afterlife in a place like this.
No more need to check up on Goblin. He was fine. Like any good soldier, if he was bitching, he was perfectly all right. I went back to Dejigore. I came back into myself inside One Eye's wagon. I was starving and thirsty. Smoke smelled bad.
"One Eye! I have to get something to eat! Where's the transients mess?"
The little black man stuck his disgusting hat into the wagon. I could barely make out his equally ugly face. It must be getting dark out already.
"For us, it's in the Citadel."
"Isn't that wonderful? Maybe I won't eat the meat." Mogaba and his cronies, still on our side then, had sat out the siege in the Citadel, dining on the occasional hapless citizen of Jaikur.
"Pretend it's chicken. It ain't so bad,"
One Eye said, just to turn my stomach. His nose wrinkled.
"Smells in here."
"I told you. You'd better get him cleaned up." He tried out his baleful stare. It didn't work. I said, "You have to live with him." Chapter 10. I thought Croker would want to catch up with Lady. They hadn't seen one another for a while, but he seemed content to rest at Dejigore, communing with his dark messengers more and more. The crows troubled those of the old crew whose duties tied them to Dejigore. Candles and Weezer came to me complaining. I told them, "He's the boss. I guess he can like crows if he wants." I studied Weezer closely, unable to believe his disease had not killed him yet. He coughed almost continuously now.
"It's what the natives think about them," Candle said. "They're bad omens to everybody but stranglers."
"I have a feeling they'll be really bad omens for anybody who starts complaining about them. Weezer, you on permanent assignment here?" The old man hacked his way around an affirmative answer. "Good, I don't think you ought to be in the field at this time of year."
"What good will it do to leave me back here to die alone?"
"You're going to outlive me, you stubborn old fart."
"I am part of this thing now. You people all the time tell us about our history, and now we got a chance to find the beginning place.
I'm going to be there.
I nodded, accepting that. That was his right. That made me reflect on how different we were from other mercenary bands I've seen. There was almost no bullying or brutality among the men. Historically, you wouldn't have gotten in if you were the sort of shit who made himself feel good by causing pain to those around you. And if you did, chances were you wouldn't survive long. The history and culture and brotherhood stuff is laid on early and often, and if you survive long enough to give it a chance, you usually go for it. Croker, of course, was the ultimate disciple of the company thing. And he was able to sell everyone else, except Mugabe. And Mugabe's main problem with the Brotherhood was that Mugabe was not in charge. Not really relevant, except to indicate that we are not a band of misfit brutes. We are a sensitive bunch of misfits who try to care about our brothers. Most of the time. One Eye appeared and invited himself into the conversation, ignoring Weezer, even though the old lunger was from his own homeland.
Hi, kid. I just saw the troll trundling along glimmers like Dewdrop Street. You sure you don't know where Goblin is? I got to get those two together.
The troll is what her own people call Mother Goda, behind her back. She's even nastier to them than to us outsiders. We have an excuse. We weren't born Nguyen Bao. I told One Eye, they made real good time considering the way she walks. My mother-in-law walks like she's terminally bow-legged and has no joints in her legs, rolling like a fat merchantman in heavy seas. The little black man slipped a glance sidelong at Tai Day, who was handy as always when not specifically told to stay away. Tai Day showed signs of actual emotion. One Eye was hoping he wasn't offended to the point where he was going to go flailing around. I whispered, even he calls her the troll sometimes. But do be more circumspect. Louder, I asked, what about Uncle Doge?
Didn't see him.
Tai Day, you'd better find your mother. Uncle Doge would find us. When it suited him. Everybody watched Tai Day go. When he was out of earshot, I murmured, I never missed her for an instant. I hoped Tai Day would find some way to prolong my joy. One Eye snickered. I said, you ask me, she's the perfect woman for you, not Goblin.
Bite your tongue, kid.
I mean it.
You got a sick sense of humor, and you got the old man aggravated.
Huh? How?
Way he told it, you're a couple days overdue with your standard reports.
Uh-oh. That wasn't entirely true, but it was close. I'll get on it right away.
Still wearing your bracelet?
Ah, I got it. Yeah.
Good. You'll need it.
Candles and Weezer had no idea what we were talking about, but Candles did offer a good bit of advice as I departed.
Mind the crows, he told me.
The crows did seem to be interested in me lately. I didn't like that. But it did make sense from a viewpoint other than my own. I was very close to Croker. Soulcatcher would want to keep an eye on me, too. The old saw applied. Forewarned was forearmed. I needed to catch up on events since last I'd had time to spend with Smoke. I should have been surveying the front instead of checking up on Goblin. Croker didn't want to know about Goblin. Whatever the little shit was doing, it was so secret, nobody was supposed to know. The string on my wrist allowed me to approach One Eye's wagon without becoming disoriented or distracted, just as it had done in the maze of the palace. The crows following me, though, began to get confused while we were still a quarter mile away. They lost me. I wondered if that was all good. That sort of thing was sure to arouse Soulcatcher's curiosity. If she had time free from her other schemes. I wondered if Smoke's attitude towards Soulcatcher would be different out here, if I could get him to stalk her now that he was away from the palace. Always, while we were there, his soul stubbornly refused to play along whenever I tried to spy on Lady's mad sister. I climbed into the wagon and made myself comfortable. It looked as though One Eye had been doing a little ghost walking of his own. Food and water were available in large quantities.
I have to eat and drink a lot when I go out a lot. Ghost walking sucks the fluid and energy out of you fast. I can see the trap there. The world Smoke walks is so comforting, you could easily forget that you have to come back to eat. You could end up just like Smoke. After a long drink and a sugar bun, I laid down on the smelly mat and closed my eyes, reached out and took hold of Smoke's soul. He seemed vaguely troubled. Usually he's blandly empty. I could find no proximate cause for his discomfort. Maybe One Eye wasn't taking care of his physical needs well enough. I had best check, after I ran my circuit. I went out and watched the Taglian brush fire crackle through feeble Shadowlander defenses. The Southerners were still groggy from the earthquake. Many places their collapse was so swift it had no chance to become a rout. Confused reports began to reach Mogaba at Charandraprash. He relayed them to Long Shadow. The Shadow Master remained convinced that we couldn't manage a major winter offensive, that this was just another of Croker's clever attempts to direct attention away from what he was really doing. Long Shadow was getting his reports without help from Howler. The misshapen, tortured little sorcerer seemed to be on vacation. I couldn't find him. Narayan Singh and the Daughter of Night were holed up in a strangler tagalong encampment near Mogaba's main force at Charandraprash. I'm not sure why, but the child caught my interest. I began to roam back and forth in time, studying her. I grew troubled. I'd found something the old man needed to know. His daughter had some way of scrying distant events, though not as intimately as Smoke did. So far, nobody, not even Singh, was listening to her, but they would when Narayan realized that all her vague oracles hit their marks. She seemed to go into a trance each time. I wanted to study that more closely, but Smoke rebelled. And this time, I'm not sure I blamed him. That child had an aura about her that made you shudder and think of tombs and things best left buried even out there in the emotionless space that Smoke walked. Lady was far to the south of Dejigore, pushing herself and her soldiers. She looked extremely haggard, though hardly showing her age, since she makes One Eye look like a pup. Willow Swan, with the royal guards, was in her train, as was the Prabhrindra Dra, who claimed he had to be there in order to coordinate his efforts with hers. I don't think he fooled anyone but himself. Lady was short enough of temper that she did not put up with any moon-eyed crap from anybody. Swan was troubled. The prince was baffled. I eavesdropped on several conversations where they tried to reason out what was bothering Lady. They came up with no ideas, and Lady offered no clues herself. Once again, she was content to keep the bleakness and pain of her interior world to herself. I supposed after a life as long as hers, as alone, as tormented when she was the wife of the Dominator, coming out and petitioning the help of lesser beings seemed pointless, though she was one of us maggots herself now, more or less. In defiance of all that was known by amateurs and experts alike, her lost powers had been coming back for years. She wasn't the lady who'd built the empire up north, so strong she kept 10 like the Howler on leashes, as hounds to bay before her and do her dark bidding. But she was strong enough to trouble Howler and Long Shadow, and, I'm sure, her sister, Soulcatcher. That was another wedge that had come between Croker and Lady. The old man doesn't trust the side of her that loves the darkness. She'd been too intimate with it for too long. He fears losing her. I'm afraid he's driving her away because he isn't dealing with his fears very well. Lady was becoming the terror of all who resisted her advance. That was certain. That advance was crueler than the earthquake, wherever anyone fought back. I found my company brethren in the thick of the action everywhere, leading this band or that. Their Nguyen Bao bodyguard stayed busy. Though they were weak after years of being hunted down by Croker and Lady, the deceivers were aptly named. Those who remained alive were the most skilled of their kind, and they shunned no opportunity to strike at the company in honor of their goddess. Though Mogaba had several thousand horsemen moving north, they weren't yet involved in the fighting. Of Shadowlander forces in the regions being swamped, only Blade's bunch had not been caught flat-footed. And Blade, after a couple of brisk, and for him, very satisfactory encounters with regiments raised by Taglian religious leaders, was making little effort to hold any territory. He was falling back toward Charandraprash at a pace just fast enough to make certain our forces didn't get behind him. His whole area of operations was becoming infested with religious bands. Ever since their falling out, Croker had been allowing the priests to go after Blade virtually independent of the rest of the military. Blade hated priests and never hid that fact. Working with the Shadow Master gave him an opportunity to express his hatred fully. In turn, the priesthoods were determined to silence him forever. The old man seemed perfectly happy to allow the priests, who had a strong tradition of intrigue and interference in secular events, to spend their treasure and energy, and most devout followers, trying to rid him of someone he detested. As he retreated, Blade kept drawing those guys in and destroying them. For a general with no formal training, he did a great job of taking advantage of his enemy's blind spots. All across the south, forces from both sides drifted toward the plain of Charandraprash. The big show would take place there before much longer. Certainly before winter turned. I came and went with Smoke. Time passed, almost without meaning. The old man got us onto the road again. I scarcely noticed. I was too busy with Smoke. Croker didn't like me being in the wagon all the time, but there was so much going on, so many places, that he had to put up with it in order to get the information he wanted, though his attitude could shift with the breeze. For a while I pretended to be sick, to give the crows and my in-laws a reason for my being in the wagon all the time. Crows are stupid. They didn't catch on. But I think Uncle Doge got the idea there was something up almost before we cleared Dejigore's south gate. Chapter 11. I was never a boozer or hophead. In this part of the world, all the major religions frown on alcohol, so there isn't a lot available. Though One Eye never has trouble finding the little there is. If none is around, he'll make some. All my life addictions scared the shit out of me. When I see a guy whose pain has driven him behind the veil of alcohol or any drug, I want to flee the same weakness I fear can be found inside me. I was becoming addicted to the freedom from pain to be found in the in-between. When I was out there with Smoke, the horrors of Dejigore and the agony left behind by Sari's murder became no more than distant, nagging aches. That weak side of me kept promising that even the faraway aches would fade if Smoke and I just kept working. I was both happy and completely miserable at the same time. My in-laws were little help. Ty Day, as ever, said almost nothing. Uncle Doge merely urged me to be strong.
Death and despair are what we endure all our lives. This world is all one of pain and loss, illuminated only briefly by moments of happiness and wonder. We must live for those times, not bemoan their passing.
We must live for revenge, Mother Gota snapped. You old fool!
She was contemptuous as she glared at me, nor did she spare my feelings.
My mother was a mad woman in her last days. We will be well rid of this weakling.
Being a weakling and not much caring for this world anymore, I didn't feel obliged to keep the peace. I bet that back in the swamp, they thanked their lucky stars every night that you decided not to come home. Tide became pure stone as I put him in a spot where his obligations had to butt heads. Uncle Doge chuckled. He rested a hand on Tide's arm.
A shaft well sped, youngster. Gota, I must remind you that we are here on sufferance. The stone soldier accepts us for Sara's sake. His master does not.
Though I have a pretty good handle on Yuan Bao these days, I knew I'd missed some key part of that. I did understand that he was telling her not to piss Croker off because he might toss them out, and that was something he could perfectly well do. He considered them little more than camp followers, and Croker hates camp followers. He considers them worse than leeches. I had to wonder if Uncle Doge wasn't interested in something more than just revenge for the murders of Sara and Tide's son, Totan. I'm not certain where we were. I think about 80 miles south of Dejigore, and passing over into territories only recently taken into our hands, where our appearance was endured with the same stoicism as the earthquake. Not much cleaning up had gotten done, because the Shadow Master's henchmen had employed the locals in a vain attempt to blunt our advance. Brave fools. Now there was no one to bury them. Total paranoia hit me there. I was unaware of the fact because I was in the wagon, but we were just making camp. I was out scouting the maneuvers of Mugaba's cavalry and sitting in on his planning session for making our lives much more unpleasant at Charandaprash. I had a sneer in my heart. He would not have a single surprise for us. From having watched Lady and all the special forces she and Croker had put together, I knew we would have plenty for Mugaba. Bright man, he expected that. He got to know Croker pretty well before he deserted to the Shadow Master. Then the paranoia hit. Smugness evaporated. Had I been in flesh, I would have begun to shake as though suddenly thrown into an icy river. I knew I was not alone. I would have panicked except for the dullness of emotion out there. I did do a sort of sudden spin around on the spirit level. For a second, I thought I saw a face not directed my way. It was a face out of a collective nightmare, as big as a cow, the color of ripe eggplant. Its smile was all fangs, and it was smiling at whatever it saw. Its eyes were plates of fire that, at the same time, seemed to be pools of darkness capable of drowning souls. I withdrew, very carefully at first, but in full flight toward the safety of reality when the face seemed suddenly startled and began to turn. I emerged too terrified to be hungry or thirsty. I was shaking and babbling and making no sense at all. The old man was close by. One eye had him in the wagon by the time I got myself under control. What the hell happened, Mergen? You have some kind of fit? You going to start going away again on me? He touched me, felt the shakes that still went right down to the heart of me. One eye. I croaked out.
I just saw Kina. I don't know if she saw me.
Death is eternity. Eternity is stone. Stone is silence. Stone speaketh not, but stone doth remember. Deep within the dark heart of the gray fastness stands a massive throne of worm-eaten wood. This throne has shifted sideways and tilted dramatically. A dark shape sprawls upon the throne, locked in enchanted slumber, nailed down by silver daggers driven through its limbs. Its once vacant face is drawn in agony. The figure draws a deep breath. Silence yields to a great, slow, rumbling beat. This is immortality of a sort, but its price is paid in diamonds of pain, in treasure by the bucket. In the night, when the wind no longer blows, and small shadows no longer creep, the fortress reclaims its silence. Silence is stone. Stone is eternity. Eternity is death. Chapter 12. South of Shadowlight, which offered no resistance, the land rose and became gorsy, stony, and as wrinkled as my mother-in-law's face. Snow lurked wherever sunlight seldom fell. Trees were scattered, but of a variety that clung stubbornly to some of its fruit throughout the winter. That fruit was tough and dry, but it grew tastier as we moved farther from civilization and any place where we could acquire more palatable foods. The route the captain insisted we follow was one that had received very little preparation, and there were no navigable waterways up which barges could carry supplies. We had cattle along, The animals could sustain themselves, poorly, off the vegetation. Those of us willing to eat flesh could gnaw on their stringy meat. But we were just getting started here, and already, I was convinced that Croker had made the wrong choice, attacking now. Those soldiers, who were vegetarians, suffered terribly. The morning wind had a real bite. This definitely was no season for travel. We could end up in real trouble if Mogaba held us up for long. That might be a good strategy for him to pursue. Just hold us at Charandaprash while all our forces came together with all their camp followers, then continue to hold us there while we exhausted our resources. Then he could slaughter the starving remnants as they tried to flee. Though he never mentioned it in so many words, part of Croker's plan was to replenish our army by seizing supplies Mogaba had laid in for his. The captain very much counted on victory now, soon, however cautiously he talked. He'd put us in a position where there was no other choice. The region around Shadowlight remained prosperous, even after the earthquake, but already that was 4 hard days' march behind us. Our foragers were eating up half what they gathered, just bringing it in. Long Shadow remained unconvinced that our advance was for real. He had a distinct problem imagining minds working differently from his own. Mogaba entertained doubts himself, though the deceivers and his own agents kept him informed of all the disasters to the Shadow Master's cause. Few of the quake-battered towns and cities made more than token attempts to resist. The captain had chosen his moment well, if emotionally. Dark gray indigo mountains spanned the southern horizon. Charandaprash was just days away. The captain slowed our advance to a very deliberate pace, so the soldiers would have more time to hunt and forage. Our part of the army began coming together in larger and larger forces. Mogaba's cavalry didn't seem much inclined to skirmish yet. Ahead of us, streamers of smoke sometimes rose as fleeing enemy caravans failed to run fast enough to outdistance our own horsemen. Our headquarters party clung to the road. Always now there seemed to be corpses lying beside it. They came in all varieties, few of them being our own people. Croker had forced me out of One Eye's wagon. I was no longer allowed inside while we were moving. So I led the way, mounted atop that giant black stallion, always presenting the black company standard. Crows were around constantly. I expect Soulcatcher, wherever she took their reports, was thoroughly amused. The standard was one we'd adapted from one she'd assigned us decades ago, based upon her own fire-breathing skull of a seal. Uncle Doge walked beside me. He carried a lance as well as Ashwand, his holy sword. He'd assumed the job of bodyguard while Tai Day was elsewhere with his mother. We too encountered all the corpses first. "There's another one that looks like a deceiver," I said, indicating a badly hacked body wearing nothing but a ragged loincloth, despite the weather.
"It is good," Uncle Doge told me.
He rolled the corpse over. The man had been run down by someone with an especial dislike for his cult. He'd been mutilated badly, mostly while he was still alive. I didn't feel a shred of pity. Men just like him murdered my sari. We encountered nothing but signs of outstanding success. But those did not inspire my confidence in the future. Roads converged. Forces massed up even more. Every hour we drew nearer Charandaprash, Mogaba and his 4 badass divisions of well-trained and motivated veterans, getting closer to soldiers who'd been getting ready for us for years, getting closer to soldiers who were not the clumsy, indifferent militias that had made up most of our opposition so far. The old man talked confidently in front of the Taglians, who didn't know any better, but I knew he had his doubts. We would have a numbers advantage, but our men hadn't been drilled until they were automatons. Our men didn't fear their officers more than they feared death itself. Our men didn't know the price you paid if you stirred the anger of a Shadow Master, not in the intimate way the defenders of Charandaprash knew. Our men had not rehearsed again and again, learning every boulder on the ground where they would be expected to fight. Chapter 13. A breeze whipped smoke and the stench of death into my face. A soldier shouted. I glanced back. The captain, wearing the hideous black Widowmaker armor Lady had created for him, was coming up. Ravens surrounded him. For the thousandth time, I wondered about his connection with Soulcatcher. You sent for me. There's something you ought to see, I think. I had not seen it myself yet, but did know what to expect. He gestured.
Let's go.
We rode up a small rise. We stopped to look at the bodies of six small brown men, far too old to have been soldiers. They lay inside a bowl that had been hollowed out of the hard ground, around a fire that still yielded a puny thread of smoke.
Where are the men who killed them?
They didn't hang around. You don't take chances with these people. Croker grunted, not pleased, but understanding the thinking of the ordinary soldier. He removed his ugly winged helmet. Crows took the opportunity to perch on his shoulders. He seemed not to notice.
I'd say we've gotten somebody's attention.
I had run into little brown men like these before, years ago, when first we'd come into the South, and more recently, in the Deceiver's Holy Grove of Doom, where I had ambushed many of their top people. A group of these Skrinsa Shadow Weavers had had the misfortune to be there on behalf of the Shadow Master. These men would have been doing the same as those others, using a gaggle of little shadows to spy and run messages. Croker pointed. Several of the old men had had chunks ripped right out of them. He observed, Lady did say you shouldn't get in the way of her bamboo toys. We'd overtaken Lady, more or less. She was following a line of advance several miles to our left. If Croker and she had stolen a kiss, they'd managed it by magic. Croker was in too big a hurry to assume complete control of his assembling center corps of two divisions. He carried a bamboo pole slung across his back. So did I. And so did every other man in the main force now. Some carried a bundle.
Oh? She'll pitch a fit if this gets to be a habit.
Croker was amused. She never was a ground pounder.
Your average infantryman doesn't give a rat's ass about the design function of a weapon. He's concerned about staying alive and about getting his job done with the least risk taken. The bamboo doohickeys were meant for combating killer shadows?
So fucking what?
If using them made taking out nasty little wizards easier, guess what was going to happen? Pop.
Chapter 14. We sighted Lake Tanji an hour before night fell. The sudden view was so stunning I stopped dead in my tracks. The lake was miles across and cold gray. It dwindled away to my right, the direction our road ran. To our left, the land was very rugged. Arms of increasingly substantial hills ran down to the water. The Danda Presh itself seemed to rise directly from the far shore, all grays in the evening light, dark down low and lighter at the peaks, where snowfields sparkled. A playful god had scrawled a thin cloud line across the panorama, halfway up the mountains, so that the peaks rode a magic carpet. Gray, gray, gray. Right then the whole world seemed gray.
Impressive, the captain said.
Not at all like seeing it through Smoke's eyes. He frowned at me, even though not even a crow was near enough to hear.
Look there.
A village burned along the shore several miles ahead. A ball of blue light streaked out of the conflagration, over the water, narrowly missed a small boat. The men aboard the boat tried to row harder, but began to catch crabs and get in one another's way. A swarm of points of light darted at them, not only blue, but green, yellow, pink, and a stunning shade of violet. A man jumped up and flailed around after a ball hit him in the throat. He fell overboard. His antics rocked the boat dangerously. It shipped water, raised its stern into the air momentarily. A ball of light zipped through its bottom, leaving a shimmering hole. Most of the balls missed. Those continued across the lake, slowing gradually. Eventually, they just drifted on the breeze and faded away. The excitement brought a flock of crows fast. They circled overhead. Two big ones dropped onto Croker's shoulders. The others scattered in pairs. The boat sank. It had been bound for an island that was little more than a rock outcrop, boasting a dozen scraggly pine trees and some half-hearted brush. A crow that got close suddenly folded up and went ballistic, hit the water, and floated without twitching. Croker glared.
Mergen, move down the foreslope out of the wind. Find a place to dig in for the night. Line troops only on this side of the ridge. I want a double watch kept. I want two battery wagons up trained on that island.
His shoulder ornaments were agitated now. I didn't mention them. He was starting to go spooky, and he didn't answer questions anyway. One of the ravens squawked. Croker grunted back. He dismounted, grabbed an extra bamboo pole from a nearby soldier, headed downhill. His mount followed the trail he broke. The soldiers who'd begun to gather followed Croker's example. They formed a skirmish line as they advanced. I could not unsling my own bamboo pole because I was mounted and burdened with the standard. I followed the men on foot. Uncle Doge formed a one-man rear guard. Two Shadowlander militiamen broke cover suddenly. They stumbled toward the water's edge. Arrows swarmed. Standing orders were to take no prisoners. The Shadowlanders had been warned. They'd been given 4 years' grace. They'd made their choices. Afterward, the soldiers began to settle in groups, finding what shelter they could, starting their cooking fires. More and more came up to the line. Our staff group gathered in the lee of a shattered boulder, everybody grumbling and shivering. Pessimists started talking about the chances of snow. I planted the standard. Uncle Doge and I got ready to make supper. There were no servants in this army. Servants ate up food soldiers could fix for themselves. Supper would be rice and dried fruit. Croker and I would add a few strips of jerked beef. Uncle Doge would add some fish meal to his rice. Many of the soldiers would eat no flesh because of religious prescriptions. I said, maybe we can find out if there are any fish in this lake. The old man looked out there.
Looks like there could be trout.
But he didn't say anything about maybe catching them. The battery wagons came up. Each had a bed, 4 feet wide by 10 feet long, packed with bamboo tubes. They were the ultimate product of ladies' arsenals. The captain supervised their positioning. He wanted them set just right. Under this overcast, it wouldn't be long before it was dark enough for shadows to prowl. East of the lake, where Lady's left-wing division was advancing through very rugged country, a single point of light shot into the air, sped southward, lost velocity, and began to lose altitude slowly. Balls in several colors followed quickly. The soldiers stirred nervously. A whiff sound came from a nearby wagon. A green fireball streaked out over the lake, its light reflecting off the water. The breeze had died. The lake surface was growing calm. I was more nervous than any of the soldiers. I'd seen what those stinking little shadow weavers could do. I'd seen men scream out their lives while something invisible gnawed at them. The soldiers had heard the stories. The sentries would stay awake tonight. The green ball didn't dip toward that island. I sighed. Maybe there was no danger after all. The wagon crews loosed another ball at regular intervals. Not a one dipped toward that island. I regained my confidence. The men began to relax. Eventually I rolled up in my blankets and lay there watching fireballs streak across the sky. It was a comfort knowing no shadow attack would go undetected. I listened to the wagon crews lay bets on what color fireball would pop out next. There was no known pattern. They were getting bored. Soon they would be bitching about getting stuck with the duty while everybody else got to sleep. Chapter 15. I was having a bizarre dream about Cordy Mather and the Radisha when somebody poked me.
I groaned, cracked an eyelid. I knew I didn't have to stand to watch. I'd helped with the cooking. I cursed, pulled my blankets over my head, and tried to get back to the palace where Mather was arguing with the Rada Shah about her plans to shaft the Black Company after the Shadow Master fell. It almost felt like I was actually there, rather than dreaming. "Wake up!" Uncle Doge prodded me again. I tried to cling to the dream. There was more to it. Something nebulous but dangerous about the Radisha. Something that had Mather upset in a major way. I thought I might be working out something important in my sleep.
"Wake up, Bone Warrior!"
That did it. I hated it when Yuan Bao called me that, never explaining what they meant. I grunted,
"What?" "Trouble is coming."
Tai Dei stepped out of the darkness.
He spoke. "Wan Ai told me to warn you."
"What are you doing up here?" His arm hadn't yet healed completely. I glanced at the captain. He was awake. He had a bird perched on one shoulder, beak moving at his ear. He eyed Tai Dei and Uncle Doge, but said nothing. He clambered to his feet wearily, collected a couple of bamboo poles, and trudged around to where he could see the lake. I followed him. Uncle Doge tagged along behind me. It amazed me that a man so short and wide could move so quietly and gracefully. I saw nothing new out there in the darkness. Occasional flecks of light continued to streak the tapestry of the night, like fireflies. There were a million stars. The guys who expected snow were going to be disappointed.
"Hush," Croker said.
He was listening to something. That damned bird on his shoulder. Where was the other one? A crimson ball zipped away from one wagon just like scores before it. But when this one neared the island, it dipped violently and swerved to the right, scattering the rippling water with 10,000 rubies. At water level, the ball became a splash of blood that faded immediately. There was no reflection off the water anywhere nearby. Shadows. A half-dozen balls streaked out. They defined a river of darkness snaking across the lake. Then balls started flying around over the remnants of the village that had been burning while that boat sank. The discharges there reached panic level quickly. The captain ordered,
"Swing one of the wagons around. Give them some support down there.
And let's see if we can't get a couple more wagons up here fast." Some individuals were plinking at the village already, for whatever help that would provide. Croker told the crew of the second wagon,
"Cut loose on that island. Everything you've got. Mergen, I want everybody awake and up here.
The shitstorm is about to hit." I ran off to tap dance on a couple of snorers famous for their bugle calls. Both wagons cut loose about the same time. Their trigger cranks squealed and rattled as they whirled. Bamboo tubes discharged color in furious series. How many balls could a wagon launch? A shitload. Cavalry tubes carried 15 charges. Standard infantry and infantry long carried 30 and 40 charges, respectively. The hundreds of tubes on each wagon were longer still. The fireflies went mad. Every single ball launched darted downward after a shadow. Each made its dip nearer shore. Lots of shadows, Croker observed laconically. This was a new thing, but a thing we'd feared for years. Shadows attacking in waves and a flood, instead of sneaking around like spies and assassins. The old man seemed calm. Me, I damned near drizzled down my leg. I ran, but only far enough to get a hold of the standard and a bundle of bamboo. I planted the former beside the old man, got the business end of a pole pointed southward, found the hand-grip trigger mechanism, and started turning. Each quarter turn sent another fireball streaking. I told Tai Dei, "Grab you some bamboo, brother. You too, uncle. This isn't going to be anything you can stop with the sword." Balls were arcing over from the far slope now. There were enough in transit to define the wave of darkness headed our way. Fireballs plunged into that darkness like bright hail, flared, faded. This was the nightmare tide we'd dreaded for so long, the hell power of the Shadow Master unleashed. Balls consumed shadows by the thousand. The flood came on. Unlike mortal soldiers, those things could do nothing but follow commands. Sorcery compelled them. My pole went dry. I grabbed another one. Uncle Doge and Ty Day began to grasp the situation. They found poles and got into the act, though Ty Day wasn't very fast one-handed. The dark tide came off the water and headed upslope. As it drew closer, I began to make out individual shadows. I saw these things first, way back when we first came to Taglios, in the days when there were four Shadow Masters, and together, they could reach a lot farther than could Long Shadow now. The Skrinza Shadow Weavers came north to kill us. They failed. But in their time, they used small shadows, few bigger than my fist. I never saw one bigger than a cat. Some in this flood dwarfed cattle. Those absorbed fireballs with no apparent effect. I saw dozens survive multiple hits. I muttered, maybe Lady wasn't as clever as she thought. Croker replied, think what it would be like without her cleverness. We would be dead already. Got you. Closer, closer. The dark wall was but 100 yards distant now. The shadows, far fewer in number and moving slower, but relentless nevertheless. Now the wagons could not depress their aim low enough to hit the shadows. They shifted their attentions to that island. Uncle Doge shouted, Drew Ashwand! I have no idea what he thought that would do to the huge cloud of darkness racing straight toward us, while a swarm of small shadows scurried around it like frightened offspring. No sword held any power against this darkness. I tried to burn a hole through the clot's heart, poised on the brink of panic. Death ravened closer and closer. Balls from the rear began falling around us as little shadows slithered in amongst the rocks. The screams began. The dark mass became a bonfire as fireballs hammered it. It slowed some more, but never stopped coming. It reared like a boar grizzly issuing his challenge. I spun my hand grip hard, yelled some kind of nonsense. That killer slice of hell's breath strained to get at me, but couldn't. It was as though the thing, at the last instant, had encountered some invisible and unbreakable barrier. The darkness radiated a dank, psychic horror. I imagined went with the grave, a hunger known only by things undead. An odor of the soul I remembered from too many bad dreams about bone-strewn wastelands and old men bound up in cocoons of spun ice. My terror grew stronger. I yanked at my hand grip long after my pole went dry, long after there was no more reason to crank. The shadow kept trying to get to me, until the barrage of fireballs consumed its last whisper of darkness. The excitement faded quickly. Only balls launched toward the island found many targets. The rock outcrop was taking a pounding from Lady's division, too, the troops over there having figured out what was happening. I thought the volume of fire so heavy it might actually consume the island. Then Croker ordered fire reduced to precautionary levels. No sense wasting our tools. We're going to run into this sort of thing again. He stared at me for half a minute. Then he asked, how did we get surprised like this? He used that juniper tongue. I shrugged. Don't ask me. I chose Forsberger because I didn't know the other well enough. I was busy carrying the standard, meaning I was cut off from smoke most of the time these days for what he considered sufficient reason. He was going to have to count on one eye to provide his warnings. Shit, he said, without much venom. Goddamn shit. Don't get clever with. A grand shriek rolled across the lake. Lady's troops loosed a furious barrage at something that darted up from the island and raced away southward. Croker grunted. The Howler. We got them scared now, boss. The Shadow Master is sending the big boys out to play. Croker showed me a twitch of the lip. Not much. His sense of humor had gone to hell lately. Maybe he lost it when he was Soul Catcher's prisoner. Or maybe when he came back to find out that he was a father. But chances were he would never see his kid. Howler escaped. We stood down eventually, but hardly anyone got any more sleep. Chapter 16. Dawn did come. It found our dead already burned or buried by soldiers who'd been unable to sleep.
I didn't have to look at one tormented face. There was no shortage of tormented landscape. It looked as though small lightnings had been on a year-long rampage around the lake. Already some of the more daring troopers were down at the water's edge collecting dead fish. Of the things that had attacked us, there was no trace at all. Croker suggested, "You might spend a little more time with Smoke." Which, of course, was more than a suggestion, though given reluctantly. He'd given up counting on one eye for anything but grief. I glanced around. My in-laws were nowhere in sight. I told him, "One eye did send warning. It wasn't what I'd call timely. It must have taken Howler and Long Shadow days to set last night up. We should have been ready." "Maybe not being ready will work out for the best, though." "Why? How?" "If we'd ambushed their ambush, they would have started wondering how we knew about it. The way it worked out, they'll just sit around cussing Lady for thinking ahead." "You got a point. But I still want a little more warning. Just don't go getting hung up on ghost walking." "What about the Standard? I don't know where Sleepy is these days, and there isn't another sworn brother handy." Nobody who wasn't company was going to touch our most holy of relics. The Standard, actually the lance from which the Standard hangs, is the only artifact we have which has remained with the company since its beginnings. The oldest annals have all been recopied time and time again, undergoing translation after translation. Croker told me, "I'll manage it. You get sick and have to ride for a while." He did, and I did. Wearing his full Widowmaker armor, he became terrible to behold once he took up the Standard. A dark aura seemed to envelop him. Much of that had to do with spells Lady had built into and onto the armor, layer after layer, for years. Even though Widowmaker was pure, powerless invention, the vision was supposed to suggest something way beyond the ordinary, was supposed to stir the observer's superstitions. So was the Lifetaker character Lady had created for herself, but hers had grown into its legend, or had been something more than invention to start. When Lady donned that armor, she resembled one of the avatars of the goddess Kina. Some of her soldiers, and more of her enemies, half believed that when she donned the Lifetaker garb, she became possessed by the dark goddess. I didn't like that idea, and didn't accept it, but Lady never discouraged it. It did touch near a suspicion I've entertained from the time I first read Lady's volume of the Annals. Could it be possible she was still a tool of that Mother of Night? Maybe unwittingly? Uncle Doge and Ty Days scowled suspiciously when I told them I was sick again and was going to ride in One Eye's wagon for a while. I'm sure Uncle Doge now knew Smoke was aboard and wanted to find out why the comatose wizard was important enough for us to carry off to war. He didn't press me, though. He remained sensitive to Croker's scrutiny. "How you doing, kid?" One Eye asked as I clambered aboard. He sounded depressed. Maybe he had a good ass-chewing from the old man. Again. "You missed some big fun last night."
"Not hardly. And I can tell you that I'm too damned old for this crap. Croker don't get us to Katavar pretty damn soon, I'm gonna drop out and take up leek farming. I've got some good turnip seed. And rutabagas. I could use a manager. Work for